give his blushing bride a whack, and Peggy would never tolerate that. 2 months went by before Red ran out of patience with the fiery woman who couldn't help but speak her mind. When she showed him a bit too much sass, he showed her the back of his hand. And that was that. Peggy moved out, and John was waiting to pick up the pieces. Before long, he proposed again. Peggy told him she'd think about it tomorrow. John smiled and said he'd heard that one yesterday. Peggy smiled back, and this time she said yes, straight away. And they lived happily ever after. Sadly, ever after would last only 24 years. Peggy was killed by a drunk driver when she was just 48. But during her time with John, she didn't just find true love. She found her true voice. With John's encouragement, Peggy started to write. She wrote about love and passion, pride and prejudice, war and death, hope, and all the things in between. Some say she wrote the story of her own life. Peggy never confirmed that. But then again, the most famous character she created was a strong-willed Southern belle, a beautiful socialite named Pansy, whom every man wanted to wed. Peggy swore up and down that Pansy had nothing to do with her. But she did choose for Pansy's husband a dashing, mercurial bootlegger, who she swore had nothing to do with Red. As for the character Pansy desired but could never possess, a man married to her best friend? No, that guy wasn't inspired by John Marsh. Not at all. Whatever the truth was, the publishers loved Peggy's manuscript. They only had one change to make when it came to the 1,037-page novel, which went on to win the Pulitzer Prize and sell 30 million copies in the process. They thought the name Pansy was too weak for the fiery character Peggy had pulled from thin air, and John convinced Peggy that the publishers were right. In real life, that's exactly how it happened. A dashing bootlegger named Red Upshaw, frankly, didn't give a damn, while an average Joe named John Marsh knew with certainty that tomorrow would be another day. As for Margaret Mitchell, she'd written herself as a pansy, though her publisher knew she was really a scarlet. And as for everything else, well, that is gone with the wind. If you ask the other John and Peggy, my parents, how they've managed to stay married for well over half a century, they'll credit an uncompromising level of honesty with each other. If you press them, though, you'll learn that their commitment to the truth did not extend to their children. Indeed, when it came to raising three boys on a public school teacher's salary, my parents lied like rugs. I remember a television commercial that used to air during Baltimore Orioles home games. It was for an amusement park in Ocean City, Maryland. According to the announcer, a visit there would amount to the time of my life. At that particular moment, my life had amounted to about 9 years. For the most part, I was satisfied with the way things were going. Then I saw the Wild Mouse. The Wild Mouse was a giant roller coaster that threatened to leap from our black and white television and smash through the wall of our tiny den. It shared the Ocean City boardwalk with the Roundup, the Tilt-A-Whirl, and other mysterious contraptions that plunged and spun this way and that. I'd never seen anything like them, a parade of machines devised for no purpose other than pure enjoyment. I remember the camera zooming in on a kid about my age. He was strapped into the Wild Mouse next to a pretty girl, his excitement teetering on the verge of rapture. I was transfixed. "Hey, Peggy, get a load of these ding-a-lings on the TV. I think they're going to puke on each other." My parents were sitting on the sofa behind me. "Oh, those poor children," Mom said. "Why would anyone stand in line all day just to get vomited on?" "Obviously, Peggy, those kids are deranged. Look at them." I searched the sea of jubilant faces for signs of idiocy or nausea. Isn't it sad, John, how some children need machines to have fun?
It sure is, Peg. It sure is.
Later, another commercial appeared, this one for a movie called Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. It was playing at the Senator, and according to the announcer, it was a thrilling film for the whole family, a must-see event. I had never been to the Senator before, or any other movie theater. I was captivated.
Tell me something, Peg. Why would anyone want to see the movie when they could read the book instead? Books are so much more interesting.
Well, John, as I understand it, movies are for children who can't read very well. Isn't that sad?
It sure is, Peg. It sure is.
In 1971, we didn't have the money for amusement parks or must-see events, but I never felt bad about missing such things. I was too busy feeling sorry for people who had to endure them. Hey, Dad, can we order a pizza tonight?
A what?
We had never eaten a pizza before, much less ordered one. The concept of food delivery was completely foreign. Bobby Price says his mother has a pizza pie delivered right to their house every Friday night, I said, and Chinese food every Wednesday. My father sighed and spoke with a hint of sadness.
Look, son, Bobby's mother doesn't know how to cook. It's not her fault they can't have normal food.
Then, quietly to my mother,
Peg, maybe you should call Miss Price. Give her the recipe for your meatloaf casserole.
Of course, John. That poor boy deserves a home-cooked meal.
He sure does, Peg. He sure does.
It was a strange sort of snobbery to develop at such an early age, this sympathy for the more fortunate. But that's precisely what my parents engendered. With duplicity and guile, they turned envy to pity. By the time I was 11, I felt nothing but compassion for classmates of mine who had been forced to wear the latest fashions. Sadly, they had no older cousins to provide them with a superior wardrobe of softer, sturdier, broken-in alternatives. One Sunday, after church, our neighbors came by with a slideshow from their most recent family vacation, hundreds of photos from Yellowstone and Yosemite. The Brannigans had stayed for hours and hours and told stories about Indians and geysers and wild bears. My brothers and I were spellbound. When they left, my dad smiled and waved as they pulled out of the driveway. But when he turned around, his expression spoke for him.
Oh, those poor bastards, it said.
Like a Greek chorus of one, my mother dabbed at her eyes with the Kleenex. Gosh, John, can you imagine flying all the way across the country just to take a walk in the woods?
No, honey, I sure can't. But then again, not everyone has a forest in their own backyard.
That's a good point, John. That's a very good point. My parents shifted their gaze toward the large tract of woods just beyond our pasture and looked with satisfaction at the epicenter of the sensible, affordable amusements that kept my brothers and me occupied on a daily basis. A swift-running creek, a swamp of frogs and cattails, an old wooden bridge, and a maze of hidden trails that might lead anywhere. Later, when I was less gullible and TV commercials were more persuasive, a new parenting style would evolve, one that included phrases like, "No," and "Because I said so." But when I entered the sixth grade, I did so with a firm understanding that movie theaters were for the illiterate, vacations for the unimaginative, and home delivery for lazy housewives who couldn't cook. As for amusement parks, they were probably okay if you didn't mind waiting in line all day for the chance to vomit all over your friends. Chapter 6, Another Tortured Artist. Back in the 70s, before the world knew him by a single name, a battered boy stared into an unforgiving mirror and considered his reflection. A split lip, a swollen jaw, a black eye. Painful, but
but not as painful as the words that accompanied the beating. "Look in that mirror, boy. Your lips are too fat for your mouth, your nose is too flat for your face, and your skin doesn't match your brother's. I'm trying to run a business here." The boy in the mirror sighed. His father was right. His face was not the face of a pop star. It was a flawed face, a swarthy face, a face that he could no longer live with. In his mother's makeup cabinet, the boy found a solution, a glass jar filled with white powder. He opened it, sprinkled some powder into his hands, and began to rub it onto his face, wincing as he did so. His wounds were still tender, courtesy of the man who wouldn't tolerate a single mistake on stage or even in rehearsal. But gradually, the boy in the mirror saw his complexion lighten. Would it be enough to mollify his violent and unpredictable father? Would it be enough to satisfy the people who paid to see him perform? Over time, as the boy's talent became more and more undeniable, those questions became less and less relevant. By the end of the 70s, the boy was famous. By the 80s, he was a national sensation. By the 90s, he was an international phenomenon. By the turn of the century, he was the undisputed king of pop. But for all his popularity, he never stopped obsessing over the color of his skin, even when his legacy was firmly in place, even when his personal life began to unravel, even when his unusual relationship with a 14-year-old boy led to a scandal and a courtroom drama. Even in the grip of depression and addiction, the king of pop concealed his true complexion right up to the day he died, alone, in his bed. If all this sounds vaguely familiar, perhaps it's because you know the story of another battered boy who stood before another unforgiving mirror 2 centuries later, in the 1970s, and considered his reflection, his split lip, swollen jaw, and black eye. Painful, but not as painful as the words that had accompanied the beating. "Look at yourself, boy. Your lips are too fat for your mouth, your nose is too flat for your face, and your skin doesn't match your brother's. I'm trying to run a business here." It's funny how history so often repeats itself. Like his predecessor, the boy in this mirror was never comfortable with the source of his own reflection. He, too, was born with a skin tone that didn't match that of his brother's. He, too, was raised by a violent, unpredictable man who exploited his talent at every turn. And he, too, left behind a collection of popular music unlike anything the world has ever seen. But unlike his predecessor, this tortured artist lived in the era of plastic surgery. If you Google his name, you can see the evidence for yourself. A new nose, a new chin, new lips, new eyelids, another new nose, new cheekbones, new hair, another new nose, new eyebrows, new eyelashes, one more new nose, and through it all, a complexion that got lighter and lighter, right up to the day he died, alone in his bed. It's tempting to blame the father for screwing up the son, and in this case, perhaps we should. By all accounts, Joseph Jackson did a real number on the brilliant, deeply troubled artist we know today by a single name, Michael. On the other hand, the old man did train and manage and shape the career of the most popular musician of our time, as did Johann 2 centuries before. Like Joseph, Johann forced his son to perform and rehearse every single day of his young life. Like Joseph, Johann relied upon his son to pay the bills, a son with a complexion that he felt was simply too dark. Yet, if you Google his name, you'll find no visual evidence of his Moorish ancestry, no portraits that reflect his natural skin tone, and no busts that reveal a single non-German feature. Thanks to a bottomless jar of white powder Johann's son was able to keep his complexion a secret, one that the Nazis were happy to reinforce 100 years after his death by insisting to the world that his unique musical genius was proof of German exceptionalism and a credit to the Aryan race. Happily, the most tortured artist of all time never knew that his music would make it onto Hitler's playlist. A small blessing, perhaps, for the battered boy, who was never comfortable in his own skin. The lonesome bachelor, who never found his immortal beloved. The legendary composer, who went deaf at the height of his powers, but kept on creating, even though he couldn't hear the applause his many masterpieces inspired. Such were the burdens of the original King of Pop, the man we remember today by a single name, Beethoven. I was reminded of Beethoven the other day as I was flicking around the TV dial. It was a rainy Sunday in San Francisco, and I had just stumbled across Steven Spielberg's Band of Brothers. Like Caddyshack, Jaws, and The Shawshank Redemption, Band of Brothers is something I can't not watch, and the scene I stumbled upon on this particular rainy Sunday is my favorite moment in the entire series. It's a scene I always rewind a few times whenever I happen upon it. It's shot in one take with a Steadicam, which I find more than a little impressive. But the mood it evokes is what moves me. The sequence begins in the wake of an Allied attack, with the old shell-shocked citizens of a bombed-out German town walking like zombies through the rubble of their neighborhood, pulling their busted possessions out from massive piles of debris. As a small group of American GIs observe the tableau, we hear what might be the greatest piece of music ever composed, the sixth movement of Beethoven's Opus 131. It's not just a soundtrack for the scene, it's part of the scene itself. For nearly 3 minutes, four German men who have just lost their homes, an impromptu string quartet, stand in the ruins. As their countrymen pick through the rubble, they play this devastatingly beautiful movement, an amazing sequence that concludes when a GI opines, "I'll say this much for the Krauts. They sure know how to clean up." "All you need is a little Mozart," another GI replies. At which point Lieutenant Louis Nixon, played flawlessly by Ron Livingston, the guy from Office Space, corrects the soldier with two lines delivered with a perfect blend of authority and world-weary wonder. "That's not Mozart," he says. "That's Beethoven." Why do I love this scene so much? In part, I think it's the juxtaposition of beauty and destruction. Placed so closely together, each magnifies the other. The combination makes me weep every time I see it. I sympathize with the German civilians, but I empathize deeply with the GI who confuses Mozart with Beethoven. As someone who's publicly mistaken on a near daily basis, I know the embarrassment of being corrected on camera. Indeed, when it comes to being corrected, you might say, I am an expert. On Dirty Jobs, I was corrected by hundreds of different bosses in every imaginable setting. As the perpetual new guy, I was corrected on windmills and oil derricks, coal mines and construction sites, frack tanks, pig farms, slime lines, and lumber mills. Today, I have a podcast that wades into history and biography and a Facebook page filled with legions of people determined to keep me honest. What I can tell you is, not much has changed, but I can also assure you, not all correctors are created equal. Take my cantankerous field producer, Dave Barsky. Like my father, Barsky's incapable of listening to a story if some stray fact seems to be out of joint. Both men will interrupt a joke if they think it's being told the wrong way, or a lecture if they disagree with something the professor says. In fact, a few minutes into this book, Barsky is going to hear about Mel Brooks and call me immediately, guaranteed. "Hey, genius," he'll say, "the vinyl record you mentioned couldn't have been vinyl. It was shellac, It had to be, because vinyl wasn't used for record manufacturing in 1944. This will be the highlight of Barsky's week. My dad, a former history teacher, will call immediately to ask how I knew that Custer's body was violated in the way I've described. "You don't know that," he'll say. "Experts still argue about it. Just because people claim it's the case doesn't make it so." His exclamation points will be bouncing off satellites and entering my ears like arrows. My mom is also a hopeless corrector of the apologetic variety. At least, she pretends to be. "Oh, Michael," she'll say, "I'm so sorry, but there's a double negative at the top of this section. You said, I can't not watch." "Sorry, Mike. It's a great story, but I thought you'd want to know." Personally, I don't mind being corrected, even when I'm right. It's nice to know that people are paying attention. But when I am corrected, I prefer it to be in the style of Lieutenant Dixon. He didn't scold the GI for confusing Mozart with Beethoven. He wasn't haughty, pedantic, or disappointed. His words came with no apologies, no exclamation points, and no attempt to lord his knowledge over his men. In fact, if you watch the scene on YouTube, you'll see that he barely glances at the man he corrects. He simply rectifies the situation definitively while remaining focused on the final few measures of Beethoven's movement. By the way, I ran into Ron Livingston a few years ago in L.A. He and some friends were eating sushi in a place called Katsuya at a strip mall off Ventura Boulevard. I was a few tables away with my high school friend Chuck. Now, I have never approached a celebrity in my life, especially one with a mouthful of fish, but I couldn't help myself. I walked over to Ron's table and stood there, quietly, making things awkward until he returned my gaze. I don't think Ron recognized me, but he did raise his eyebrows in the universal expression that says, "What the hell do you want?" As his friends and my friend looked on, no doubt asking themselves the same question, I leaned in, paused for dramatic effect, and said, "All you need is a little Mozart." For a moment, I thought he would leave me hanging, but he didn't. Lieutenant Dixon swallowed his fish, took a sip of his beer, and with barely a glance in my direction, said precisely what I hoped he would say. "That's not Mozart. That's Beethoven." Point is, the story that comes next doesn't include a single mistake. But if you hear one, please drop by my Facebook page and tell me all about it. And while you're there, say hello to my dad. Chapter 7. Size Matters. Bill had a big one, no doubt about it. But Craig's was bigger. Not by much, but in a contest where every inch mattered, Craig had more inches. So Bill made a few adjustments. Soon, his was bigger than Craig's, at which point Craig made some adjustments of his own. Now, Craig's was bigger than Bill's again. And more interesting to look at, thanks to the enormous tip on the end. But Bill had one more trick up his sleeve. When the measuring finally stopped, one of these men could proudly claim to have the world's biggest erection. When it comes to New York City architecture, size matters. No one knew that better than these two famous partners who'd become bitter rivals in their quest to erect the tallest building in the world. Their partnership had been legendary. Bill was the artist, a brilliant architect, but mostly void of charisma. Craig was the consummate businessman, handsome, silver-tongued, and highly motivated. Together, they had been a perfect team. Craig landed all the high-profile commissions. Bill designed the impressive, groundbreaking structures that made them both rich. Unfortunately, their egos grew apace with their bank accounts. You see, Craig was an accomplished architect in his own right. He didn't appreciate the constant newspaper articles that raved about Bill's artistic genius. And for his part, Bill resented being seen as the boardroom lightweight, incapable of handling big deals. He hated the way the clients looked at Craig whenever they talked about money. Eventually, the artist and the businessman went their separate ways in a very public, very nasty divorce. Then, as fate would have it, each one landed the commission of a lifetime. In 1928, Bill was contacted by a business tycoon who wanted him to design the tallest building on Earth. Bill agreed and submitted plans for a soaring tower in Midtown Manhattan, 809 feet tall. Shortly thereafter, Craig agreed to design the Bank of Manhattan Trust Building, down on Wall Street. According to his plan, he would build a grand tower, 840 feet in height. Well, when Bill learned that Craig's design was 31 feet taller than his, he quickly added 2 extra floors to his blueprint. Craig responded by adding an extra floor to his. Bill followed suit. Soon, both men were flirting with 900-foot designs. The public was transfixed. They watched as Craig gained the advantage. The base of his tower was broader than Bill's and could support more floors. Then, Bill found a unique way to stretch his upper floors, adding extra height and dramatically altering the aesthetics in a way that no one had ever imagined. When the final designs were approved, everyone assumed the battle was over. Bill's tower in Midtown would be the tallest building in the world. Craig's tower on Wall Street would be a close second. But a man like Craig could never be second banana, especially to his former partner. Both towers were completed in 1930. Then Craig whipped out his secret weapon, that giant tip, which he called the lantern, along with the flagpole that brought 40 Wall Street to 927 feet, 2 feet taller than Bill's Midtown Tower. 40 Wall Street was the tallest building in the world now, and Craig rejoiced in every glorious inch. For about a month. Because a man like Bill wouldn't be second banana either, especially when his former partner was the man in the number one spot. Secretly, Bill had constructed a 185-foot spire, codenamed the Vertex. Its existence was known only to the small group of steelworkers who had built the massive pinnacle and stored it in the building's elevator shaft. And so, on May 22nd, just 30 days after Craig laid claim to the world's biggest erection, Bill rode a private elevator to the 71st floor of his Midtown masterpiece. He looked out upon his former partner's looming behemoth 6 miles to the south. Then he gave the signal. A giant crane hoisted the Vertex into place, making Bill's erection the biggest in the world and flipping his former partner the biggest middle finger ever raised over Manhattan. Of course, erections are unpredictable things. Size matters, obviously, but by no means is it the only measure of satisfaction. Bill, for instance, in his haste to make his building bigger, overlooked something that Craig, the consummate businessman, would have never ignored. He forgot to get a signed contract with his client. Now, the tycoon who had hired Bill was refusing to pay his full commission. Bill took the tycoon to court. Eventually, he got his money. But in those genteel days of boater hats and pocket fobs, a lawsuit was considered an ungentlemanly way to do business. By fighting over the size of his commission, this brilliant architect, Bill Van Allen, destroyed his own reputation. And even though his iconic tower is now considered by many to be the most significant structure ever to grace the Manhattan skyline, the tycoon who paid for it, Walter Chrysler, turned out to be his final client, and the Chrysler Building, his last public erection. Unlike Bill the artist, Craig the businessman was well paid for his efforts at 40 Wall Street. His building is no longer the second tallest in the world, or the third, or the fifth, or even the 25th. But it's worth remembering that for one glorious month in the spring of 1930, nobody had a bigger one than H. Craig Severance, an architect who relished the art of the deal more than the artistry of his chosen trade. Something perhaps for the current owner to reflect upon, another New York builder who, from time to time, has ruminated upon the importance of size, a man whose last name now appears on the facade of 40 Wall Street in big gold letters, enormous letters, maybe the biggest letters in the whole world, T-R-U-M-P. Okay, they might not be the biggest, but they are definitely huge. Regarding erections, you know what they say. If it's not one thing, it's your mother. In this case, my own. In her book about my mother, Peggy Rowe wrote unashamedly about her love for all things equine. As a teenage girl, she routinely slept in the barn, preferring the company of horses to people. According to my grandmother, she often missed meals and skipped school to dote on the ponies in her charge. Not much changed after she married my father and brought her three sons into the world. Our purpose, as best we could tell, was to pick up the endless piles of steaming manure that littered the modest pasture behind our farmhouse, while she made sure that the horses were fed, watered, exercised, brushed, fed some more, brushed again, and tucked in for the night. Sometimes, after that, she would feed her children, but with far less enthusiasm. When I was 12, my mother entered me in an equestrian competition at the Maryland State Fair. She was determined to instill in me the same sickness that had infected her, and resistance was futile. "Mom," I said, "I don't want to ride English. It's for girls." "Don't be ridiculous, Michael. The finest riders in the world ride English. Any fool can hang on to the horn and gallop around on Western tack like a drunken cowboy." That sounded good to me, far preferable to the navy blazer with black piping that I was compelled to wear, along with creamy spandex breeches, a blousy pirate shirt, and knee-high black boots. Worst of all was the helmet, a rounded bowl of a thing far too small for my already bulbous head, covered in smooth black velvet and held in place with an elastic chin strap. I was so appalled by the thing, I could only stand there while Mom affixed it to my head. I looked like a Pez dispenser on a pony named Tammy. The competition didn't end well. The humiliation lingered, as humiliation often does, and to this day I remain deeply suspicious of spandex, helmets, and females named Tammy. But those earlier memories have long since been eclipsed by a series of misadventures on various ranches and farms featured on Dirty Jobs. The first, and I suppose the most memorable, took place in Texas, with some assistance from a quarter horse called Paid by Chick, a beautiful creature whose ability to ejaculate on cue was far more humbling than falling off Tammy midway over the first jump had been. Paid by Chick was led into the stable and brought to a pommel horse, a piece of gymnastic equipment whose name finally began to make sense. On the other side of the pommel horse, a mare in heat was waiting. Well accustomed to that daily dance, Paid by Chick was already ready. My job was to approach the animal and guide his manhood, or horsehood, if you will, in all its vascular tumescence into an artificial vagina, thoughtfully presented to me by a veterinarian named Dr. Christine. The tumescence was humbling. The vagina was a bright blue container about the size of a bread box. Imagine a hot water bottle with a heavy-duty fabric handle on the top. Dr. Christine handed me the device along with the tube of lubricant and a baby bottle. "Go ahead," she said. "Squeeze some of the lube into the artificial vagina." "How much?" I asked. "Can't have too much lube," she said. "Now go ahead and screw that baby bottle into the back end." "I beg your pardon?" "Plug the back end of the artificial vagina with the baby bottle, so the semen has somewhere to go. Just go ahead and screw it in." In the long history of sentences I'd never heard before, that was another one. Sooner would be better, she added. Over on the pommel horse, Paid by Chick had assumed a position of pure, undeniable readiness. His front legs were draped over the side. His eyes were focused on the mare, just out of reach. His horse hood was thrusting pointlessly into midair. Okay, I said. I'm ready. I approached the engorged beast. Hold on there, champion. You don't approach a horse in that condition without one of these. Last week, one of our best grooms got knocked unconscious. Occupied, as my hands were, with a fully lubricated artificial vagina, augmented with a semen-catching baby bottle, I couldn't accept the yellow bicycle helmet Dr. Chris was offering me. I could only stand there, appalled, as she affixed it to my head. Like the velvet monstrosity from my youth, it didn't fit, not even remotely. But, once again, I was in compliance and ready for action. Moments after that episode aired, Mom called to congratulate me. Oh, Michael, you're so lucky. Paid by Chick is one of the greatest quarter horses alive, and you look so handsome in your little bicycle helmet. Thanks, Mom. The whole thing was humbling. Yes, she said. I imagine it was. I saw no need to mention that 3 minutes later, Paid by Chick had humbled me yet again with an encore performance. A performance that filled my baby bottle with another deposit of white gold. A performance worthy of all the close-ups, slow pans, and artistic dissolves that made Dirty Jobs the family-friendly show it was. After all, she is my mother. Chapter 8. Can you be there by 9? Al sat on the back of a horse that wasn't his, drew a pistol that wasn't loaded, and shot an Apache who wasn't an Indian. The stuntman screamed and fell unconvincingly to the ground, and the director yelled, "Cut! Back to one, everybody. Let's do it again." Al glanced nervously at his watch. 6:30 p.m. Not good. His audition was at 9 the next morning. St. George, Utah was 7 hours from L.A. by car, and Al didn't have a car. All right, everybody, here we go. Ready? And action! Once again, Indians whooped and charged, townspeople screamed and scattered, and Al pulled the trigger, shooting the same guy for the 10th time that day. But now, when the Apache, who wasn't an Indian, fell to the ground, the director called, "Cut! That's a wrap, everyone. Check your call times for tomorrow." Al knew his call time already. 3 p.m. Tight, but doable. He turned his horse away from the set of Bullet for a Bad Man and rode hard toward the nearest highway. It was rough terrain, but he could handle a horse. You probably knew that, if you'd seen him in Springfield Rifle with Gary Cooper, The Big Trees with Kirk Douglas, or The True Story of Jesse James with Robert Wagner. For a big man, he rode well. 5 miles later, as the sun was about to set, Al reached the highway. He dismounted, turned his horse back in the direction of the stables, and gave it a slap on the rump. One thing about horses, they always know where the stable is, especially around dinner time. After that one left in a cloud of dust, Al knew that there was no turning back. He stuck his thumb out, and 2 hours later, an 18-wheeler finally pulled over. "Where you headed, cowboy?" "Los Angeles." "I can take you as far as Vegas." "I'll take it," said Al. Al jumped into the cab. The truck driver said he looked familiar. Al asked him if he liked the movies. "Sure," said the driver. "Who doesn't like the movies?" "Well, did you see Dive Bomber with Errol Flynn?" "I don't think so." "I was in that one." "Oh, yeah? What else you been in?" "Well, I was in Up Periscope with James Garner." "Didn't see it." "Time Out for Rhythm with Rudy Vallee?" "Nope." "What about Rogue Cop with Rod Taylor?" "Sorry." "To the Shores of Tripoli with Harry Morgan?" "Negative." "The Sea Chase with John Wayne?" "Uh-uh." "The West Point Story with James Cagney?" "Doesn't ring any bells." By the time they arrived in Vegas, it was firmly established that Al's driver was not up to speed with his passenger's resume. But Al didn't mind. With a wife at home and four kids to feed, Al didn't care about being recognized. He just wanted to work. That's why he was busting his butt for a chance to audition for the role of Jonas Grumby, the final character to be cast on a new show for CBS. His agent said he looked like a Jonas Grumby, and Al couldn't disagree. The driver dropped him at McCarran Field, just in time to see the last flight to L.A. take off without him. Al slept in the terminal. The next morning, he boarded the first flight to Burbank, landing a half hour before his audition time, and grabbed a cab to the studio. Al smiled when the cabbie picked up exactly where the truck driver had left off. "You got one of those faces," said the cabbie. "Where have I seen you?" "I don't know," said Al. "You like the movies?" "Sure," said the cabbie. "Who doesn't like the movies?" "Ever see Mon Cher Beaucaire with Bob Hope?" "Don't think so," said the cabbie. "I was in that one," said Al. "Oh, yeah? What else you been in?" Al sighed. "Hometown Story with Marilyn Monroe?" "Didn't see it." "How about Battle Hymn with Rock Hudson?" "Not yet." "No Time for Love with Claudette Colbert and Fred McMurray?" "It's on my list." "Young at Heart with Doris Day and Frank Sinatra?" "Uh-uh." Al arrived at the studio with 2 minutes to spare. He didn't look like a man who had ridden a horse, hitched a ride, and slept in an airport just for a chance to audition for a role he probably wouldn't get. Nor did he look like a man who would be flying back to Utah in less than an hour to shoot some more Apaches who weren't really Indians in another movie that no one would ever remember. He looked like a Jonas Grumby, the smiling, bumbling, exasperated character he'd come to read for. Al glanced again at the lines, which he'd already memorized. He walked into the room. A skinny kid with a funny hat on was waiting in front of a camera. Al shook the kid's hand, and they chatted briefly about the scene. Then somebody said, "Action!" That was that. Magic. No one would ever look at Al again and wonder where they'd seen his face. Thanks to that audition and 5 decades of syndication, Al's face would be forever seared into America's retina. Jonas Grumby would accumulate more screen time than all the stars that Al had ever worked with combined. And so, when he died in 1990, Al's ashes were sprinkled over the Pacific Ocean, a fitting send-off for the man who became synonymous not with the cowboys he'd so often portrayed or the Indians he'd so often shot, but with Jonas Grumby, the sailor, whose name was changed after the show's pilot to the one you know today, the ubiquitous title by which he was called every day for the rest of his life. Such was the fateful trip of Alan Hale, Jr., a great character actor who just happened to be an actor of great character, a man whose 12-hour odyssey from St. George, Utah, to Los Angeles, California, earned him a 3-hour tour to a deserted island that wasn't really deserted, an island where he was known as the Skipper, even though the real boss was a skinny kid with a funny hat named Gilligan. Alan Hale Jr. never won an Oscar or an Emmy Award. He was never even nominated. But if Hollywood was in the business of recognizing character, surely there'd be a trophy somewhere with his name on it, maybe even a statue. Because what Hale did back in 1964 was nothing short of heroic. Imagine, you're a middle-aged character actor. You're not rich. You've got a wife and 4 kids, all of whom depend on you. In the middle of a paid gig in Utah, you sneak away on a horse that isn't yours and make your way to Los Angeles on the off chance that you'll land a role you know nothing about. Then you get back to Utah in time to do the job you've actually been hired to do. Alan Hale Jr. didn't give a damn about fame. He believed in something far more noble, something Hollywood has never recognized and probably never will. He believed that a promise made was a debt unpaid. specifically the promise he'd made to care and provide for his family. That's what makes him a hero to me, and that's why his journey reminds me of another voyage by another actor, a regular guy who taught social studies for 30 years, started a vocational training program at the junior high school where he worked, raised three boys on a single income, and appeared in 50 productions of better-than-average community theater. The first time I saw my dad on stage was in 1975, when he played the lead in a production of Woody Allen's Don't Drink the Water. The character was Walter Hollander, a middle-aged American tourist trapped with his family at the U.S. Embassy in a fictitious country somewhere behind the Iron Curtain. I was transfixed. Who was this man inhabiting my father's skin? Why was everyone laughing hysterically, not just at the things that he said, but at the way he said them? Where was the no-nonsense teacher who'd come home every night and loom over me as I did homework? The stern taskmaster who woke me up every Saturday at 7 a.m. to split wood, mow the lawn, and shovel the snow? Don't Drink the Water split my father's personality in two. He was still my dad, still a dedicated teacher and church deacon, still the reliable head of our household. But every 6 months or so, he became an entirely new person, someone with bulging eyes and a funny accent. All that his wife and sons could do was watch the transformation, marvel, and take turns running lines with him. I recall a production of Agatha Christie's Towards Zero. Dad played a Scottish inspector called in to investigate a murder at a country estate. From the front row, I watched him confront the guilty party with damning evidence. The expression on his face was one I recognized immediately. It was an expression that accompanied countless other investigations, all conducted in the house I had grown up in. And whose muddy boots left the dirt on the carpet? And who drank the last of the milk? And whose socks are these, jammed into the sofa cushions? Such questions, directed to my brothers and me, were always accompanied with a raised eyebrow and followed by some dramatic revelation. The muddy boot, empty milk carton, or wayward sock, held high for all to see. Aha! As a sleuth, he was a natural. My father's innate desire to get to the bottom of things informed his understanding of history and his desire to teach it to eighth graders as much as it drew him to plays that posed the question, who done it? Dial M for Murder, Witness for the Prosecution, 12 Angry Men, A Shot in the Dark, The Butler Did It, Death Trap. Dad's done them all. His portrayal of Judge Danforth in The Crucible comes back to me all the time. We burn a hot fire here. It melts down all concealment. Sitting in the front row at the Dundalk Community Theater, I was sure that his lines were directed at me. And seeing that there was more to my father than I had imagined made me wonder if maybe there was more to me. Mom certainly seemed to think so. One day, Michael, you'll be the star of the show, just like your father. If watching my dad was a privilege, working directly with him was an honor, a role, you might say, I was born for. In The Rainmaker, he played a sheriff who arrested me for trying to convince desperate farmers that I could make it rain during a drought. In Inherit the Wind, he played a judge, again, and threatened to send me to jail for contempt of court. That, too, was a very believable portrayal. 7 years after Dad's debut in Don't Drink the Water, I appeared in a production of the same play. Not in the same role. I was still too young to play a middle-aged American tourist. I had auditioned for the part of Axel McGee, the hapless son of the U.S. ambassador who'd fallen in love with the beautiful daughter of Walter Hollander, the character my father had played. The production was staged at the Cockpit in the Court, one of the more respected venues on the Baltimore theater scene. I had butterflies on opening night. I remember the audience murmuring on the other side of the curtain as the lights dimmed. But what I remember most clearly his dad, in the front row, laughing loudly in all the right spots, no doubt wondering, who is this young man inhabiting my son's skin and getting all of these laughs? Coincidentally, or maybe not, my dad was back at the cockpit in the court while I was writing my story about Alan Hale Jr., auditioning for a role in another production of, you guessed it, Don't Drink the Water. Now that he was in his mid-80s, he was too seasoned to play Walter Hollander. But, thanks to a passable Russian accent and his no-nonsense demeanor, he did get cast in the role of Krojak, a KGB investigator determined to get to the bottom of things. Watching from the front row, I thought about his many roles over the many years, all the rehearsing, all the time he spent memorizing lines. I thought about the hospital he volunteers at 2 days a week, and the shut-ins who anticipate his cheerful delivery of Meals on Wheels every Monday. I thought about the former students who stay in touch with him, and the church that still relies upon him to collect and count the weekly offering. And I thought about the three boys he'd raised on a single income. After the show, he told me that things weren't as easy as they used to be. But as anyone who knows my dad understands, easy was never the point. My guess is that Alan Hale Jr. understood that as well. Chapter 9, A Full-Figured Gal. Libby was a tall drink of water, no two ways about it. A statuesque, full-figured gal who was, in the words of Rodgers and Hammerstein, broad where broad should be broad. Beyond her classic beauty, though, Libby possessed another quality that most men found irresistible, a quality that suggested anything might be possible with a girl like her. Fred had conceived Libby 20 years earlier. Her mom had never really been in the picture, but it would be unfair to call Fred a single parent. Fred loved his girl as much as any father could love a daughter, but it was Gus who had actually raised her, and now Fred and Gus were trying to arrange a marriage, searching the world for a man who would put their girl on a pedestal. For a time, it seemed that that man would be the governor of Egypt. Ismail Pasha was handsome, charming, and clearly enamored of Libby. He said all the right things and promised to build her a fabulous home right there at the entrance of the newly completed Suez Canal. Fred was delighted. Obviously, Ismail was Muslim, but Libby didn't care about that. She'd wear the veil in public, if doing so would please him. But after 2 years of courtship, it became clear that Egypt was not the right place for a woman like Libby. Libby took the rejection in stride, but Fred was beside himself. He had wasted 2 years with Ismail, and his little girl wasn't getting any younger. So Fred and Libby sailed to America to find a more suitable suitor. To everyone's surprise and delight, the mayor of Baltimore proposed. So too did the mayors of Boston, Philadelphia, and San Francisco. American mayors seemed to have a thing for full-bodied gals who radiated possibility. But ultimately, it was a Hungarian immigrant who persuaded Fred that New York City was the only sensible place for his daughter to call home. At first glance, Joe was not an obvious match. He was a slender man who had been described as too scrawny for manual labor. Next to Libby, he looked like a kid. But Joe knew exactly what he liked and precisely how to get it. Back in Missouri, as a reporter for the St. Louis Post, he had worked hard and saved his money. Eventually, he'd bought the entire newspaper. He'd bought the St. Louis Dispatch as well. Then he'd moved to Manhattan and bought a newspaper called The World. New York was where Joe first laid eyes on Fred's daughter. That's when he proclaimed on the front page of his new newspaper that Libby would stay in the city with him. Fred was delighted. Obviously, Joe was a foreigner, but Libby didn't care about that. There was only one problem. When Fred told Joe that he and Gus wanted to see Libby on a pedestal, he wasn't talking in metaphors. He was talking about an actual pedestal, one that would cost the city of New York no less than $250,000. That's the equivalent of $6 million today. Sadly, Joe didn't have that kind of cash lying around, but Joe was a man who knew exactly what he liked and precisely how to get it. So, 150 years before crowdfunding became a thing, the journalist from Hungary turned his newspaper into a GoFundMe page and challenged his readers to keep Libby in New York City. Philip and Eliza Bender were among the first to contribute, with 50 cents each. Joe printed their names, along with his thanks, right next to a photo of his beloved. Their kids pitched in, too, and Joe printed their names as well. Anna, 25 cents. Franny, 25 cents. Leonard, 10 cents. Frank, 15 cents. Alice, 10 cents. Ralph, 10 cents. Carrie, 10 cents. Miss Nicey, 25 cents. All in all, the Benders were good for $2.30. And everyone read all about it. Soon, hundreds of New Yorkers began donating their pocket change. Street sweepers, carriage drivers, stonemasons, housewives, ordinary men and women with only pennies to spare. Anyone who donated saw his or her name in the newspaper next to an image of Libby. Within months, the necessary funds were in hand, and soon after that, on a place called Bledsoe Island, the construction of a mighty pedestal began, a pedestal sturdy enough to support the full-figured gal that Joe was determined to keep in the Big Apple, the 450,000-pound, 151-foot statue called Libertas. Frederick Bartholdi had conceived her and given her a name. Gustav Eiffel had raised her and given her a frame. But it was the immigrant from Hungary who'd given the lady from France a place to stand. Without Joe, Libby would be overlooking some other harbor, Philadelphia's probably, or maybe Baltimore's, or she'd be in some other country. She'd almost wound up behind a veil, at the mouth of the Suez Canal, dressed in the robes of an Egyptian peasant. Instead, she stands at the foot of Manhattan, where she welcomes the tired, the poor, the huddled masses, yearning to breathe free. It's funny. An immigrant, famous today for the prizes bestowed in his name, is largely forgotten for his greatest gift, the campaign that kept our favorite lady right where she belongs. Thanks to thousands of New Yorkers, their pocket change, and a man named Joseph Pulitzer, we can say that, once upon a time, America put liberty on a pedestal. I had a pedestal once. I put a pig on it. You can Google it. Go ahead. I'll wait. Are you back? Good. Let's continue. By 2005, Dirty Jobs was an undeniable hit, but the network and I couldn't seem to agree on how best to promote it. They wanted a traditional marketing campaign with me at the center of it, a working-class hero earnestly attempting to master every blue-collar trade. That made me very uncomfortable. Dirty Jobs was not an earnest show, nor was it a show about me. It was a lighthearted tribute to real people who woke up clean and came home dirty. What I wanted was a campaign where everyday people were not only featured, but treated like stars. I imagined them dressed in their work clothes as they appeared in the show, arriving in limos at a star-studded red carpet premiere, where they'd be swarmed by paparazzi and greeted by throngs of adoring fans. Barsky, my intrepid field producer and partner in grind,